War.
From WBUR Boston and WRNI Providence, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. For 26 years, Robert Fisk has reported the people, politics, and passions of the Middle East. The Beirut-based correspondent for London's independent newspaper has seen high hopes and horror. And for the last year, America's response to Islamic terrorism. Tonight, we're asking for Robert Fisk's critique of that response, of what America calls the war on terrorism. First, Washington has been discussing compensation for Turkey if war with Iraq breaks out. Turkey lost billions of dollars in tourist revenue and trade when it helped America during the first Gulf War. It's worried about another economic blow this time around, and Washington wants to guarantee a key ally. I spoke earlier today with Bradley Graham, military affairs reporter for The Washington Post. I asked him what steps the U.S. is taking to reach out to Turkey in advance of a potential war with Iraq.
U.S. officials have begun discussions with Turkish authorities over how to compensate Turkey in the event of war with Iraq. If you remember, the last time the United States went to war with Iraq in 1991, Turkey lost billions of dollars in tourism and trade and other costs associated with the war. And there's a lot of concern that if war should come again, that Turkey would experience some of the same economic losses.
Is there a dollar figure being put on this American aid or compensation to Turkey at this point?
None has surfaced publicly, and what I'm told is that there's still quite a large gap between what the Turks have suggested they would need and what the Americans have indicated they might be willing to pay. But these are still very preliminary discussions. They haven't really entered the stage yet of formal negotiations. It may be a while before we see any hard and fast numbers.
And is this United States buying Turkey's loyalty or support during a war with Iraq, or would it come with or without this kind of package?
Well, of course, officials on both sides prefer not to put it in those terms. In fact, some U.S. authorities hesitate even to talk about compensating Turkey. They prefer to describe what they're trying to do is provide some kind of safety net for Turkey as a loyal ally. I mean, certainly Turkey would be essential in any war with Iraq as a staging area, major staging area for U.S. warplanes as well as U.S. troops. There is little question that Turkey would go along with the United States, however reluctantly, because the United States is a big friend and major patron for Turkey. Turkey is a longtime member of NATO, the only Muslim country in NATO, but it would be in both the U.S. and Turkey's interest, of course, for the Turkish economy not to totally collapse under the strain of costs associated with an Iraq war.
Bradley Graham, you've written that U.S. diplomats are making the rounds throughout the Gulf region and the Middle East, touching up relationships and looking in on what's required with a lot of countries. In Turkey's case, beyond serving as a staging area, how else might Turkey interact with a war on Iraq?
Well, you know, Turkey borders on Iraq. It has a border of 100 or 200 miles in northern Iraq. Northern Iraq, of course, is populated largely by Kurds, and Turkey also has a large Kurdish population. It's actually been a problem for them, Turkish-Kurdish separatists. And so the United States is looking to Turkey perhaps to help control the flow of Kurdish refugees that might be expected out of northern Iraq. Possibly also Turkish troops could be used to help guard any prisoners of war that might be taken in northern Iraq. But there's also a U.S. concern that Turkish military not use the chaos of a war to seize territory in northern Iraq and a Turkish effort to try to combat these Kurdish separatists.
Turkey has been very focused on getting into the European Union. We hear George Bush speaking out on behalf of that effort today. Is that also part of this effort to tighten up Turkey's friendship, loyalty, support in advance of potential war?
U.S. support for Turkish involvement in the European Union long precedes the whole war on terrorism and the focus on a potential war with Iraq. But these continued efforts, particularly the escalation of the U.S. support up to the top levels of the government involving President Bush, are much appreciated in Turkey.
What form might special U.S. support for Turkey, a kind of compensation, I suppose, for its support in war with Iraq, take? Is this, are we talking about cash or something else?
Well, but some of it could be cash, could be grants in the name of promoting economic reforms in Turkey. It could be special consideration for defense contracts or transfer of military equipment. It could be preferential treatment and trade, you know, providing tariff-free access to U.S. markets for Turkish goods. It could be help in securing contracts for Turkish firms and the rebuilding of a post-war Iraq.
You mentioned sales of arms to Turkey. There's been resistance to that since the late 90s from human rights quarters concerned over Turkey's treatment of the Kurds that you mentioned earlier. Is the United States, in addition to compensation, perhaps willing to turn a blind eye to human rights concerns to win Turkey's support?
Certainly there's been consideration within the administration of trying to provide Turkey with some new military equipment. Particularly, one hears of discussions about attack helicopters that the Turks would like. But as you say, there is likely to be some resistance in Congress if the administration moves too quickly, at least, to provide equipment to Turkey that would not be directly related to any role Turkey might play in a war against Iraq.
Bradley Graham, finally, Turkey recently had elections where a new leadership with strong Islamist roots came to power. Is Washington feeling nervous about its relationship with Turkey, that a new day's begun and has to reestablish a strength of relationship there?
There was some uncertainty, although the first signs of the new leading party in Turkey have been encouraging to U.S. officials here, particularly in the selection of some of the top ministerial jobs in the new Turkish government. Some of those nominees are regarded here as very well qualified, very sophisticated, particularly in their approach to Turkey's economic difficulties.
So far, so good, but a little extra economic support never hurts.
That's true.
Bradley Graham, thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
Bradley Graham is a military affairs reporter for The Washington Post. I spoke with him earlier today from Washington. Yesterday, U.N. weapons inspectors returned to Iraq. Tonight, a vast new homeland security bill has passed the U.S. Senate. U.S. military forces are gathering for a potential war on Iraq. We've all seen the military swing into action since 9/11. We've seen American police and intelligence forces working overtime. But what aren't we seeing that we might? Are we getting to the root of the problem? Are we ready and willing to go there? You can join the conversation tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Joining us tonight from New York is Robert Fisk, Middle East correspondent for The Independent and author of Pity the Nation, The Abduction of Lebanon, now out in its fourth edition. He's seen more for more years of the Middle East than perhaps any correspondent on the planet. Good evening and welcome, Robert Fisk.
Hi there.
Hi, thanks for joining us tonight.
You're welcome.
Robert Fisk, you've been a bracing guest on this show ever since the early weeks after 9/11. We're glad to have you back tonight. We're more than a year now into America's response to that event, and we're looking for perspective. We're counting on you to help us out with that tonight. I hope you'll sit back with us and kind of turn the sphere of American response, look at what's there, look at what's missing. But if you would, just give us your sense overall. You watch mostly from the Middle East. How do you assess the United States' performance in responding to the challenge, the shock of 9/11, a year and more on now?
I think it's pretty miserable. We didn't think in the immediate aftermath of September the 11th, 2001, that we were going to be going to war, as we appear to be, against Iraq. We thought this was all about Osama bin Laden and al-Qaeda and the fact that they could exist in Afghanistan. It turns out suddenly that we want to go to war with Iraq, and there is clearly no palpable proof of a connection between Iraq and what happened and those international crimes against humanity that occurred in Washington, New York, and indeed in Pennsylvania. At what time, I asked myself, and perhaps you can think of the same answer or question, at what time did Osama bin Laden fade from our TV screens to be replaced by Saddam Hussein? What on earth has Saddam Hussein got to do with September the 11th? It seems to me that this is nothing to do with a war on terror. This is a war against America's perceived enemies, or at least the Bush administration's enemies. There is clearly no positive proof that there was any connection between Baghdad and September 11th. There's quite a lot of proof that Al-Qaeda was involved, and there's also quite a lot of proof that Al-Qaeda hates Saddam Hussein. Mm. We've got bin Laden clearly back on the radar screen, courtesy of bin Laden himself, and the tape, which my paper confirmed a week ago, was indeed bin Laden's voice. Mm-hmm. We've got a situation in which we have the Americans complaining bitterly about human rights abuses in Iraq, abuses that were going on back in 1983 when the Americans were actually reopening their embassy. And indeed, the envoy they sent to do that was a man called Donald Rumsfeld, who was shaking Saddam Hussein's hands back then. It seems to me that what we should be looking at is this. First of all, why did September the 11th happen? The one question that we were not allowed or not supposed to ask in the immediate aftermath. Now, these guys, we know they were Arabs. These mass murderers were killers. They came from the Arab world. They said they were Muslims. They claimed to be. We know 15 of them came from Saudi Arabia, one from Egypt, one from Lebanon. What is it in the society in the Middle East that produced these people? What kind of anger, fury, rage, however twisted or warped we may regard it, what kind of history produced these people? Instead of dealing with the society from which they came and talk about, well, is it fair? Is it just? Have our relations with these people, indeed with all the peoples of the Middle East, been right? We're not doing that. We're advertising our new weapons and saying, well, this is even better. Look, now we can strike from the sky without actually having pilots in the aircraft. This is going to lead ultimately to exactly what Donald Rumsfeld said when he slipped up that time and said, war without end. I can only remember what Lawrence of Arabia said about this kind of thing. He said, once you start a war, it's like trying to drink soup off a knife.
Robert Fisk, and yet from the very early days after 9/11, this was defined as a war on terror. And as you say, that has now expanded to potentially soon include a war on Iraq, whether or not one agrees that that appropriately belongs in that bag, in that definition. How might the United States have gone about it differently? How might it go about it differently even now?
Look, we always have the question, when we have a crisis, what do we do now? And every time one says, as I did in 1990 after the invasion of Kuwait, hang on a minute, who created Saddam Hussein? How did he have all these weapons? Who gave him the gas? The Germans did, by the way. Who gave him the photo reconnaissance pictures to wage war against Iran? They came from the Pentagon. Always we end up in a situation where we commit grave political errors in the Middle East. And then when we have to deal with them militarily, we say, oh, let's not get into how this happened. How do we deal with it now? The issue is this. Unless we deal with the grave injustices which exist in the Middle East, this society will continue to produce people who are prepared to do the most wicked and terrible crimes against humanity. If we're just going to try and shoot them down, it's not going to work. We need to deal politically on the ground with what the problems are. I mean, one of the points that bin Laden keeps making, one of the reasons he's genuinely popular, I'm sorry to say, in the Arab world, he complains about the hundreds of thousands of children who've died in Iraq under UN sanctions. He complains about the occupation of the West Bank and Gaza. He asks why so many American troops are in the Arab world. Why are they? Why are American troops in Jordan? Why are they in Egypt? Why are they in Saudi Arabia? Why are they in Kuwait? Why are they in Bahrain? Why are they in Qatar? I'm asking the question myself. Mm-hmm. And unless we deal and can think of some answers to this, if those questions go unanswered, unless we can change the situation so those questions don't even need to be asked, there are always going to be bin Ladens out there. Instead of that, we want to invade another country, Iraq. And as I said, which has nothing to do with September the 11th. You know, there is also, if we want, a perfectly bloody conflict going on in the Middle East already between the Palestinians and Israelis. It seems to me that what we need, you know, the United States was very popular after the Second World War. People trusted it. Mm. Woodrow Wilson, the president of this country, was the man who invented the League of Nations, effectively, and actually wanted genuine independence for minorities throughout the Middle East. Why is it that suddenly a country which started the last century with immense goodwill in the region, a country which has the immense ability with its financial power and its military power to actually bring about some real justice for all people in the Middle East, simply cannot do it except by concentrating on military power alone?
Well, we're stepping by none of those questions tonight. We want to dig in with you, Robert Fisk. We're glad you're here to help us do it. We're looking for an alternate perspective tonight, perhaps to a mainstream perspective, an alternate to that, certainly. We're talking tonight with Robert Fisk, getting his correspondent's critique of the war on terror. He spent 26 years in the Middle East. He's seen maybe more than any other correspondent on the planet of that part of the world. And we're asking, beyond troops and global policing efforts, what should the United States be doing to respond to terror? Are we facing up to the whole picture or just the part we can shoot at? You can join us tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight with Middle East correspondent Robert Fisk. We're getting his correspondent's critique of the American war on terror. The question for you listeners is, are we facing up to the whole picture here or just the part we can shoot at? Are we being fully honest, fully aware in our assessment of the terror threat? And have we shortchanged the battle for hearts and minds in the Arab world? You can join us tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-8255. Talk, Robert Fisk, you don't talk like Donald Rumsfeld, and tonight we're welcoming that. We're kind of giving you the microphone. Let's say we're imagining we're giving you the power. We're imagining or looking to imagine an alternate approach to what's transpired here. We don't want to forget the history, but speak to us about how you, with your perspective, imagine a more productive way, if there is one, of addressing the hell of a mess we're all in right now.
Well, I think, first of all, though Americans may not like the fact, being the world's sole and only superpower with its immense power economically, culturally as well, of course, militarily, socially, politically, there is a very heavy burden of responsibility upon the United States. Many Americans may say they don't want it, but they've got it. Their country is powerful.
A kind of responsibility that we're not acknowledging, that we're not picking up?
Well, I want to tell you about what I think that responsibility should be. I think there's a special responsibility in these circumstances to try and exercise some genuine political fairness in the Middle East, which is provoked or, if you like, promoted not by America's own interests, but by the interests of the people who live in the Middle East. In other words, instead of allowing our policies to be dominated, and I say our, I mean, I'm also talking about our own dear Prime Minister, Tony Blair, instead of allowing our policies to be dominated by oil, by propping up Arab dictators who do what we want, and bombing them, of course, when they stray away from what we want, instead of saying we want democracy when we don't actually do anything to encourage democracy in the Arab world, instead of demanding, for example, that Saddam Hussein has to obey all UN resolutions, which he should, and then ignoring the fact that Israel does not have to obey, for example, UN Resolution 242 about withdrawal from occupied territories, America needs to realign itself fairly across the spectrum and deal neutrally with the problems of the Middle East in the interests of the people of the Middle East, Israelis, Arabs, all the peoples of all religions. And I don't think it does that. I think what America does is it strikes out at its enemies and also at Israel's enemies, because more and more the US administration regards Israel's policies and its own policies as the same thing. And as long as that's the case, there will not be peace. And there will be the same kind of horror and violence visited upon all the people, Israelis as well as Palestinians, as we've seen going on so far.
Robert Fisk, in the immediate aftermath of 9/11, when everyone was still shocked, everyone was still horrified, but there was a sense that, I think among Americans, that the country would engage in some real reassessment of its posture there, that clearly there was a policing problem here because we couldn't have people taking over airplanes and crashing them into office towers. But on the other hand, some kind of reassessment and perhaps a new path politically, diplomatically might be required. From your vantage in the Middle East, do you see evidence of the United States going through that, of it being evident on the ground there?
No, absolutely not. I don't think, I must say, you say that, you know, everybody waited for some kind of new path, etc. I didn't sense that at the time, either when I was in the United States following September 11th or in the Middle East. When you have a president who thinks he's fighting a war against evil and is in fact sometimes using the very language that Osama bin Laden uses, for heaven's sakes, there is no new path going to be followed. I think one of the problems that followed September the 11th was a complete imbalance of perspective. Now, I understand why Americans should feel like that. When I'm in New York, where I am now, when I'm in Manhattan, I feel palpably this is where this crime against humanity happened. But when we are told that the world has changed forever because of September 11th, I'm sorry, but I think this is rubbish. Over and over again, and from my perspective, I'm talking to you in the Middle East, people say to me, in 1982, 1,700 Palestinian civilians were massacred in the camps of Sabra Shatila by Israel's phalangist allies in 2 days. In 3 months of that same year, 17,500 Lebanese and Palestinians, almost all of them civilians were killed in Israel's invasion of Lebanon. In Syria, in February of that year, Syrian forces killed up to 20,000 Syrian civilians in the city of Hama. Nobody lit candles for any of those people. No one had memorial services, no one remembered them, and no one said the world has changed. And the world did not change. But many times Arabs say, look, for moral and religious reasons, we are appalled at what happened on September 11th, 2001. But we have also suffered, and you do not tell us that the world has changed when we suffer.
If we take the Fisk critique on board, and granted, it does not look like a popular critique in the White House today, and I would say in response there, to
I'm
say the very least,
and
I would say that though George Bush may have described this as a battle of good against evil, and some people cottoned right onto that explanation, others, I'm sure, saw that as perhaps a hair too simple an analysis. But let's say we take the Fisk critique. Where does it lead us? You say, well, you can't just stick up for oil. You can't just stand by dictators. You can't stand by tyranny. You've got to support fairness. Each of these sound like such radical departures from where we've been that they're hard to get to. Can you describe some of the bridges from here to there? What might we have done other than gathering wars for Iraq?
Well, you might have done what Colin Powell and President Bush said they were going to do earlier this year and have an international conference on the Middle East in the summer. We were told, I remember the headlines in my own paper and in the American press, that there was going to be a major international conference on peace in the Middle East to try and deal with what was becoming, and of course what has already become much worse, a major conflict of blood and enmity between Israelis and Palestinians. Yeah. That international conference never took place. That promise was not honoured. Now, with the European Union, with Russia, with China, with the United Nations, the Quartet and so on, with the United States, with a certain amount of balance of the international powers involved, we might, with an international conference, have been able to discuss openly, not behind closed doors, the basic issues which have caused such desperation and humiliation and anger throughout the Middle East. Some of those issues involve Israelis feeling angry, of course, and with good reason. They feel betrayed. But we didn't do that. We didn't have an international conference. Many Arabs believe that was a simple lie. I'm often asked, why wasn't there an international conference? I have no idea. I just don't think Bush was interested.
How do you interpret the U.S. response? Is this just a gut instinct to go so hard on the military, the policing, the intelligence side, and so soft or so absentee on the rest of the agenda? I realize this isn't your beat. You're a visitor here. It's not what you cover. But how do you interpret the American response?
Look, I think there's a number of things involved here, and it would go on far too long to go deeply into every one. I think you must take into account the extraordinary power which Christian fundamentalism now exercises in the United States. Over the administration, there is a Christian fundamentalist in the White House to some extent, you know.
Born again, at least.
Yes, well, I let you say that. I think you're absolutely right. We have to count the fact that never before, I think, have there been so many supporters of Israeli lobby groups, both past and present, in the U.S. administration, to the point that American policy, I mean, America is setting out to redraw the map of the Middle East in a way it has not been done since the British and French victors over the Ottoman Empire in the First World War did in the aftermath of the 1914-18 conflict. And what they're doing is beyond Israel's wildest dreams. Over and over again, the Arabs interpret this. I'm not sure I do all the time, but certainly the Arabs interpret this as effectively Bush doing what Israel would really like to do, at the same time as Bush permits the continuation of the building of settlements for Jews and Jews only on Arab land in the West Bank and Gaza, at the same time as which U.S. firepower is being used by the Israelis against the Palestinians, and with no apparent real attempt to deal with any Palestinian leadership, which might at least be able to end the wicked practice of suicide bombings. It looks like a lazy Bush administration, as well as being a brutal one.
Lazy, but Israel too would benefit from peace in the Middle East. And of course, there are many people who want it. There's certainly people want suicide bombing to stop, and you can't blame them for that.
I certainly don't. I think that suicide bombing is a wicked and evil fact which has emerged from the conflict. But I think you also have to say, look, over and over again, Israel's been given opportunities for peace. This April, the Arabs gathering at their summit in Beirut, led by Crown Prince Abdullah of Saudi Arabia, offered peace with Israel, recognition by the Arab states in return for the withdrawal of Israelis from occupied territories. And this, remember, this occupation is the world's last colonial war. settlements are being built since 1993 in the Oslo Agreement. The number of settlers in the occupied territories has gone from 200,000 to 400,000. If you want peace, you can't do that.
It's a big map. Israel's part of it. There's a lot more as well. A lot of callers want to join this conversation. Robert Fisk, please stand by. I want to invite them in. Dale's calling from Erie, Pennsylvania. Welcome, Dale. You're on the air.
Hi, how you doing?
Fine, thanks.
Hey, I'd like to take issue with your guest.
Please.
I think it's he's very slanted, very slanted liberal perspective toward the Palestinians. If for instance, Israel would give up part of their land or go along with proposed peace settlements. You have a group called Hezbollah that has the stated fundamental tenet of their belief is the annihilation of Israel. Mm-hmm. There's simply nothing anywhere before, now, or in the future to suggest that Israel giving up occupied territory would stop the suicide bombing.
Dale, I'll turn that to Robert Fisk in just a moment, but let me ask you first, if that's the case, what does that lead you to believe is the way out of this? Is it endless war, or is there some solution that you can see?
Well, I don't think it's endless war. I think fundamentally, though, you have to concede that this conflict has been going on since Ishmael and Isaac, which is a very
that's
long
a long time.
Time.
That sounds like
and,
endless.
And let me say something else, Tom. Fundamentally, we're dealing with two sides that are claiming that they have the truth, and what each side has is completely different than the other. And I think historically, looking at who has the better historical claim, I think it's very clear historically that Israel has a valid claim.
Dale, and yet we want to get out of exactly that Gordian knot. Let me put your comments to Robert Fisk. Robert Fisk, you're slanted, you're liberal, you're misrepresenting the Palestinians, you've got it all backwards.
I'm very definitely not a liberal. I think that war criminals should be put before an international court. Unfortunately, the United States doesn't want an international court. I think we should see Saddam Hussein tried fairly before a court for his crimes. I think we should see the Assad family of Syria put before an international court for the bloodshed that's occurred. I think we should have Sharon of Israel tried fairly, of course, for a court over his, as the Israelis themselves said in 1983, personal responsibility for the massacre at Sabra and Shatila. But I think we need to get down to a few facts here. First of all, Dale says, if Israel would give up part of their land, the West Bank and Gaza is not part of the State of Israel. It never has been, and internationally it's never been recognised as such. There are many Israelis who say exactly the same thing, and there are many Israelis who would, although Dale may not realise it, disagree profoundly with what he says. The Hezbollah have nothing to do with the Palestinian so-called Intifada. They're a Lebanese movement. They were the people that drove the Israeli occupation army out of Lebanon.
But they do have
although,
a lot to do with Israeli
I've noticed
security
that they
today.
Have recently. Well, I'm sorry. Look, I have one thing to say about Israeli security, Arab security, American security, mm-hmm. British security. They lie through their teeth. If you want to know about Hezbollah, I think they've been dabbling with some Palestinian groups in the past 2 years, but they are effectively finished of their war, except for one small area, which is called Sheba Farms, which once, and in fact, mm-hmm. legally
right
does belong to Lebanon.
Mm-hmm.
It's on the border between Israel. It's on the border between occupied Syria and Lebanon, not between Israel and Lebanon. But nonetheless, that's a small point. We could talk for an hour about that. The fact is, there is no historical claim that is valid internationally. Whether Israelis believe or not, or whether Dale does, that God gave the land of Israel to the Israelis today. The fact of the matter is that if we're going to say that God now gets involved in land claims, what has happened to the legitimacy of the law? There are Palestinians at the moment who hold land deeds to land which they own, bits of territory which they own in the West Bank and Gaza, and it is being taken from them by people who say they can have this land because God gave it to them. That is indeed a recipe for continued war. But let me come back in here. I think that Dale doesn't understand. There are quite a number of Israelis who believe that the whole system of settlements and occupation is a detestable crime, that unless it ends, there will not be peace for Israel. And I think you've got to understand that it isn't just a question of backing what Sharon says or the inanities that the president of this country says about Israel and the Middle East. We've got to take into account there are people in all the countries of the Middle East, Arab as well as Israelis, who understand what this injustice means. You've got to realise that many Palestinians, their last hope lies in the fact that there are Israelis. I'm sure that Dale would call them liberals, but Israelis nonetheless, and they take the risk of living in this country, which we do not, who say that there must be an end to occupation, there must be an end to settlements, the settlements must be closed down, it is colonialism.
Oh, we should note that only today a new Labour leader was elected with exactly that view, but then on the other hand, the Labour Party is in the distinct minority in Israel at the moment. Robert Fisk, stand by. I want to get more callers in. Dale, thank you for your call. John's calling from Erie, Pennsylvania. Hi, John. You're on the air.
Hi. I'd like to thank Mr. Fisk, first of all, for saying what I've been thinking for the past year. Why are we not addressing the issue of why these things are happening, why these anti-American sentiments are in the Arab world? It's clear from looking at history that the Muslims and the Israelis have been at each other's throats since biblical times. And I think that this anti-American sentiment, or anti-Western sentiment, I should say, has been growing ever since the Crusades in the Arab world.
But, John, do we have, I guess a question from the White House might be, do we have time to think about that? We've got a country to protect here.
Our only hope is to address that issue, is to address why these people feel this way and see what we can do to change their perspective of us.
Yeah. John, we've got it. Thanks for your call. Robert Fisk, what about this issue? We've got deep-seated issues here, not only between Israelis and Palestinians, but right across the region, and we've got real-time security threats. How do you put together solutions to enormous political, historical problems with the kind of policing fears and threats that the American government and others are thinking and worried about every day right now?
But the United States does not want to use policemen. This is the whole point. There's never been any plan of getting people like Osama bin Laden before a court. Again, I repeat, America doesn't want an international criminal court. This would be the institution to bring justice to criminals in the Middle East, for example. I think, of course, here I'm going to say John is a man of great sensitivity and judgment because he agrees with me. But nonetheless, the fact of the matter is that we're either going to deal with this sanely and rationally, or we're going to think we're fighting world evil, which is ridiculous. No American president has ever before talked in this kind of rhetoric. Actually, it's the rhetoric of Christian fundamentalism. Twice now he's actually talked about a crusade. The fact of the matter is that what is happening is that the ideology behind the White House is even beginning to interfere with security. Look at the situation, for example, where immediately after September the 11th, people, Arabs from Iraq, from, I think, Lebanon, Syria, Iran, which, of course, is not an Arab country, they would risk having been fingerprinted, special security checks when they came to America. But the Saudis, for months afterwards, continued with no security checks, even though 15 of the 19 killers were Saudi. In other words, the ideology of the axis of evil took precedence in American security over the reality of who the killers actually were. And now we have a situation where, for example, Mr. Bush says he wants democracy in the Middle East. We don't. We want these people to obey our orders, not to elect parliaments who might not do what we want.
Robert Fisk, stand by. We've got to take a break. We'll be right back. We're talking with correspondent Robert Fisk tonight, getting an alternate view, not the White House view, of the war on terror, the situation in the Middle East. Are we fully deploying brains and brawn in the war on terror? Are we really thinking this through? You can join us tonight at 1-800-423-8255. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight with correspondent Robert Fisk. He's Mideast correspondent for the Independent Newspaper of London. We're getting an alternate view of the Middle East, of the war on terror, not the White House view, but a correspondent's critique of the entire situation there and how the U.S. is responding to it, how the U.S. is responding to the threat of terror. You're welcome to join the conversation as well. Robert Fisk is with us. He's out with his fourth edition paperback edition of Pity the Nation, his story of Lebanon and its torture over many years. Tonight we're talking about a bigger picture, about the U.S. role in the region in response to terror, beyond troops and global intelligence efforts. What should the U.S. be doing to respond to terror? Are we getting to the root of what's wrong? Do we really want to get there? You can join us at 1-800-423-8255. Brian's calling. Hi, Brian. You're on the air.
Hi, thank you for taking the call.
Sure.
Yes, I think your guest is right on. A question I guess I would have is, as a correspondent who certainly knows media, how does he think that the U.S. media, which for the most part largely ignores these types of issues, is going to address this in an educated public that's really, you know, in the dark on these issues? I mean, you might see the Homeland Security bill passing tonight, get a half a minute of coverage on the news tonight, and then it's on to, you know, the accident on the interstate. It's just there's no coverage.
Brian, thanks for your call. Robert Fisk, how about it? What picture does the United States get through its media?
Doesn't get a picture at all, which, by the way, is why hundreds of thousands of Americans, and this is a fact because we can prove it on the Internet, are turning through the Internet, an institution I don't actually like, to foreign newspapers, not just The Independent, my own paper, but to The Guardian in England and those who speak French, to French newspapers like Le Monde and Libération. You know, you talk about an alternative view. An awful lot of European journalists working out of the Middle East would adopt that alternative view and would not take the White House view of it. The problem in America, I'm afraid, is that the coverage in what I suppose we call the mainstream media here, and I'm a mainstream reporter for a mainstream newspaper in Britain, mm-hmm. The coverage here is so gutless, so biased, the language so decontextualized. Over and over again now, for example, we find that the occupied territories are referred to as disputed territories, as if this is just a matter of a land deeds, that settlements for Jews and Jews only built on Arab land are referred to as neighborhoods. This kind of language is being used more and more in the American press. The Associated Press, largest American news agency in the world, won't refer to the occupied territories as occupied. It now calls them war won. What a tongue twister. Must have been very difficult to find that to escape from the word occupied. I don't think Americans are getting the truth from their own newspapers, their own media. One of the reasons now why on the lectures that I'm giving across the states, I'm doing 2 weeks of lectures at the moment, I come here almost every 3.5 weeks, I get a minimum of 1,000 people. This is unheard of before in America when a foreign lecturer comes. It's not because it's me, it's because Americans are turning up, and it's clear from the questions and answers at the end of the lectures I give, Americans are turning up because they think they're being suckered. They know they're not being told the truth by their own television and their own newspapers.
There's the Robert Fisk view. Brian, thanks for your call. Michael's on the line. Hi, Michael. You're on the air.
Hey, thank you for taking my call.
Good to have you.
There's been a lot of people that have been going back to the biblical times to really get on this topic. I think you could really look at modern times, at the very creation of Israel, to really see the intolerance of the Muslim people. It was down to every single country. It was said that they were going to drive Israel into the sea. And I was just wondering what your caller had, you know, his comments on, you know, the intolerance of the Muslim world.
So you're saying give Israel a break here. They're fighting for their lives.
Yeah, exactly.
Muslims are the intolerant
exactly.
ones.
I don't agree with the settlement. And I think they are going a little overboard, but they do have a justification in a history.
There's a lot of history.
Yeah, there is a lot of history, but I think you just look at modern times, and I think there is a real intolerance running through the Muslim world right now, and I think it's been that way for a little while. And
Michael, let me put it to Robert Fisk. Robert Fisk, how about the Islamic or the Muslim side of this equation? It's certainly not all joy and peace rallies there.
No, I'd like to come to that, but first I wonder if I can ask Michael, he's not the first person in this program, to talk about the justification in history for Israel to have this land. Can you tell us what this justification in history is?
Michael, do you want to do that?
Well, I think it's the justification of the Muslim world not even allowing they've been calling Israel the cancer of the Muslim world, and I think that's totally uncalled for. You know, to call a people a cancer. You know, that's really I'm used to a religious tolerance in this country, and to hear people call another people a cancer in the midst of their region, you know, that's totally uncalled for. I wonder what he thinks about that.
Robert Fisk, it sounds like that's what Michael's got to offer. What do you say?
Right. Well, I'll quote a previous chief of staff of the Israeli army who referred to Palestinians as cockroaches in a glass jar. The new chief of staff of the Israeli army has talked about Palestinian violence as a cancer against which he's going to use chemotherapy.
But the point is it goes both ways.
Let me just
finish,
if I may just finish.
Mm-hmm.
Michael put forward quite correctly the fact that Muslims have said the most terrible things about the Jews of Israel, but I'm afraid many of the leadership in Israel have also said some pretty terrible things about the Muslims. What we've got to do is look like this. We're not talking about justifications in history. I thought we were going to have a history lesson about the Bible there for a moment. We've got to remember, if we want to talk about history, this. For many hundreds of years, Jews escaping from Christian antagonism and Christian viciousness in Spain sought refuge and lived for hundreds of years in peace with Muslims in North Africa. There was a long period in Andalusia when Christians, when before Christians were able to drive them out, when Muslims and Jews lived together in a renaissance, a splendid period of Spanish history which we've now completely forgotten. The fact is that Jews and Muslims can live together. But when we have outside powers involved, and remember, the State of Israel came about approximately 30 years after the British made conflicting promises to the Muslims and the Jews. We British, we promised independence to the Arabs if they joined in our side against the Turks in the First World War, and we also gave our support for an Israeli or at least a Jewish homeland in Palestine, all of Palestine, we implied, though the Israelis didn't get all of it. We gave conflicting promises and we kept neither of them. These two peoples are the victims of the malign curse of history, of our grandfathers, indeed, of the First World War, in which my own father fought as a young soldier.
Robert Fisk, we've got half a minute left.
We need to keep that perspective there.
Yeah. I want to ask you, in the half minute we have left,
yes,
on the course that we're on, where do you see us headed?
I wake every morning in Beirut with a sense of great foreboding. I think we're going downhill. I think we're heading for darker and darker wars and the possible overthrow by local Arab armies of their own regimes. I think things are moving out of control, and very soon I think we'll see they're out of America's control.
Can we see the map of the Middle East successfully redrawn?
Not like this. The only people who can redraw maps are the people who live in the Middle East.
Robert Fisk, it's always bracing. Agree or not agree, listeners, there it is. The view from the man from Beirut, Robert Fisk, is out with the fourth edition of his book, Pity the Nation, The Abduction of Lebanon. Robert Fisk, thank you for joining us tonight.
You're welcome. Thank you for allowing me to come and talk.
Listeners, you can continue this conversation online at onpointradio.org. Click on forums. In a moment, remembering actor James Coburn, this is On Point.
You know, I've been working and doing this work for, like, over half my life. And I finally got one right, I guess. See, some of them you do for money, some of them do for love. This is a love child.
Academy Award-winning actor James Coburn died yesterday of cardiac arrest at age 74. Coburn's long career in Hollywood covered more than 80 films. Never in the tip-top echelon of actors, and never really comfortable as a leading man, Coburn's tall, lean, flinty presence and arresting, deep voice led directors to fit him into roles as the dark villain and the quiet, tough guy. Our on-point movie maven, Garen Daly, reflects on his memories of James Coburn and what made him an unmistakable Hollywood presence.
One of the very first films that I can remember as a very young boy was seeing The Magnificent Seven. In that film, which is an adaptation of Akira Kurosawa's The Seven Samurai, seven guys go to a Mexican village and defend the Mexican village against the banditos. There was Steve McQueen, there was Yul Brynner, there was Horse Buckles, and a couple other people. But one of the people that stood out in my memory, and I just loved seeing him on the screen, was this guy named James Coburn. He was so cool. He moved slowly and deliberately. He had this wonderful economy of style, and he said very few words in this film, but he had such a presence that you just wanted to watch him and see what he was doing and what was going on. And what he did that was very good, and what I think really entranced me as a young boy, was he made me feel like I was part of his humor. I was part of what was going on inside of him. Things were moving in his brain, and he was drawing me into the screen. And in it, his introduction to us is great. He's sitting in a pen outside of a railway station, just laying on the ground with his back against the fence, and some guy is like egging him on because apparently he is the fastest knife thrower around, and this guy thinks that he is a faster pistol drawer, and he wants to challenge him to a duel, knife against gun. And he says everything with his body language, and then in a very Calvin Coolidge kind of way, he just lays it all out.
You see, I won. Well, how about it? Well? Elaine, how about it?
I don't know. It's mighty close, wasn't it, boys?
Close? What do you mean, close? You all got eyes. You saw what happened. I won. You tell him. I won, didn't I?
You lost.
All of a sudden, Hollywood realized they have this kind of Gary Cooper-ish kind of actor here. Someone who's got tall, lean, very charismatic. He becomes very closely allied with Steve McQueen, and they do a couple of movies together, including Hell is for Heroes and The Great Escape. And he gets to be a very solid character actor or a buddy to another actor. Then in 1965, after James Bond had just blown the entire Hollywood spy thing completely to shreds, they decide to do a spoof, and they bring James Coburn in to play Derek Flint in two movies. The first one is Our Man Flint, and the sequel, which is just as good, In Like Flint. Now, these are precursors to what Austin Powers are. They're wonderful satires, and the thing that works really, really well here is, again, because of Coburn's ability to project a sense of humor that draws the audience in, they're willing to accept him in absolutely ludicrous situations.
Flint, tell me, didn't there used to be four?
Well, there were five at one time, sir, but that got to be a little too much. You see, I'm trying to cut down. Come on, Eric, you've had your lunch. Now, sir, what's on your mind?
After he did the In Like Flint movies and the Our Man Flint movie, he really could have cashed in at that point. He was very, very popular. He was someone who could easily have made a whole bunch of In Like Flint movies. But he decided he needed to grow as an actor. He needed to try some different things. So he put that aside and tried to do some other things. He did films like Last of Sheila, which is a very good film. He did Convoy. He actually worked as a second unit director in Convoy. He did a lot of different things. But some of his choices weren't very good, and he had a lot of duds. He went to Europe, worked with Sergio Leone, came back, started doing a few villain roles, and then something tragic happened to him. He contracted rheumatoid arthritis, and it was incredibly painful. He literally laid low and dealt with his illness for almost a full decade. But what really was very gratifying for me as someone who sits on the outside and watches these things is that in 1997, Paul Schrader made a film called Affliction. He put Willem Dafoe and Nick Nolte as these two brothers whose father was this alcoholic, abusive, mean, nasty human being. And he cast James Coburn to play that father. It was so good that at the Academy Awards that year, he won Best Supporting Actor.
My old man, now there was a real man. You let no women push him around. Worked till the day he died. Yeah, men like him were real men. And women knew their place. There was no confusion.
Isn't it amazing that this particular film at this particular time in his life culminates not only in an Oscar for him, but it also is something where he can take incredible pride that he acted. He brought all of the stuff that he learned on TV in the 50s and in the movies in the 60s, and even his own pain. You can almost feel that his pain that he had in his hands was part of the pain that he was pushing out in this role in Affliction. It was incredible. It was the culmination of a career. What a way for him to like wrap it all up.
On Point's movie maven, Garen Daly, remembering actor James Coburn. Coburn died yesterday in California. He was 74. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
Cassettes and CDs of On Point are available for $15. Go to onpointradio.org or call 1-800-909-9287.